This is the afternoon magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Historian Heather Cox Richardson says the story of Reconstruction is more than the story of the rebuilding of the South after the Civil War. She says that it rebuilt the country, gave us a national identity, and set the stage for the U.S. to become a world power. Heather Cox Richardson is our guest in this portion of the program. She is the author of the new book, West from Appomattox, The Reconstruction of America After the Civil War. The book takes readers from 1865, the end of the war, to 1901 with Teddy Roosevelt in the White House. Richardson says the book explains why today's political map looks the way it does. She says, quoting here, it argues that in the years between 1865 and 1901, a new definition of what it meant to be an American developed from a heated debate over the proper relationship of the government to its citizens. Richardson tells the story of this transformation by looking at the lives of people who lived through the period and left behind accounts of their experiences. She also has included characters unknown to us, for better and for worse, all making a mark. Listeners, I look forward to your questions and comments for our guest, Heather Cox Richardson. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Heather Cox Richardson is Associate Professor of History at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. West from Appomattox is Richardson's second book. It is published by Yale. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Richardson, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
In this book, you say you set out to tell the story of the construction of our middle-class ideology, and you say this ideology is both a triumph and a tragedy. What are the strengths and weaknesses of this worldview?
Well, the great strength of it is that it includes more people in a rise to a solid lifestyle, to security, than many, many other different kinds of ideology. That especially after the Civil War, there was room in America for ex-slaves and for immigrants and for some Indians and for different people to make their way in society and to have stable lives. The negative side of that is, in order for that to be the case, in order for this ideology to include people, it also dictated the exclusion of certain categories of people who could never be included in that middle-class vision. So it's both the strength of America in that it offers people who might not in other countries have options this incredible chance. It is truly the land of opportunity, but that opportunity depends upon guaranteeing that not everybody can make it.
Yeah. And we see this, as you point out, you point this out in the book, we see this reflected in our symbol, the cowboy.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? And the reason that I wrote this book was not actually to find out about the beginnings of the middle class. There are a lot of historians who study that very topic, and they look backward to find where today's middle class came from. I actually wrote this book because I didn't understand Reconstruction, and I didn't think that the way I had looked at it in the past made a great deal of sense to me. So the more I read about Reconstruction, the more it finally dawned on me that most of our enduring cultural symbols of Reconstruction are not the things that we study in today's history books of life, black life, especially in the South, or even of the Northern industrialists, but rather they're the cowboys. They're the Indians. They're the miners. They're Jesse James and Billy the Kid and Sitting Bull and Geronimo. And they were the people that made me realize that we had to look at the period in an entirely new way.
Yeah. Well, talk with us a little bit about here, give us maybe an overview about the significance of the role of westward expansion in the transformation of the nation following the war.
Well, it's really important to remember that although we tend to study the Civil War as being an Eastern phenomenon, even when we talk about the Western theater of the war, we really are only talking about Missouri and Kansas, to some degree Texas, There was, in fact, a West out there. There was a West during the Civil War, and the North was very aggressively settling it, not only because it was desperate to get gold and precious metals from the mines in order to pay for the war, but also because the entire war had been sparked about who was going to be settling out there. Was it going to be Northerners without slaves, or was it going to be Southerners with them? So as soon as the North possibly could, it starts settling and making territories out of the Western previously unorganized territories. So even during the war, there is dramatic growth in the West and a deliberate attempt of the Congress to move to the West. Of course, they pass the Transcontinental Railroad Act to get settlers out there. They try and encourage settlement in the West. Then as soon as the war is over, the West becomes very, very important as both the cattle industry, because the cattle industry comes out of Texas immediately after the war from all the cattle that have been bottled up down there. When the Union takes the Mississippi River, it means that cattle can't come across the Mississippi any longer, and as a result, the cattle end up actually going feral down in Texas. And it's not rocket science to realize if you can just get them to places like Chicago, you can make a killing on them. No pun intended. They were about $3 a piece in Texas and about 40 in Chicago. So if you could just get them to a railhead, you were going to make a fortune. So the West becomes a great place of industry, the cattle industry and also the railroad industries. So first of all, that's the story that we tend to miss, but it becomes important in American society and in the way we think about the country, because the people who are running the cattle industry are Southerners. And Southerners hate the federal government with every fiber of their being, not only because of the war, but also because of the legislation after the war, like the Freedmen's Bureau, which brought federal soldiers into Southern towns and into Southern homes. They are strongly against the federal government. And Westerners, as Southerners go up through the plains, and as Westerners, as Northerners also settle out there in the West, they come to hate the federal government not only because of Reconstruction Acts, but also because of Indian policies and other land policies. So there comes to be this image of the West as an anti-government place, even though the government is so actively involved in settling it. The settlers there come to believe that they stand against the government, that they are doing everything without the government's help. And back east, people who also hate the government take that rallying cry up. So the West becomes this great symbol of the man who's doing it on his own, who's against the government. And that really becomes the central focus of American ideology after the Civil War.
Mm. It's the script is changing, isn't it? The narrative.
The narrative for today or for the...
Well, the foundation for today's narrative is back with this move west, in terms of what, you know, the political conflicts we see today and how we identify ourselves, that narrative was laid down, the foundation for the stories we tell about ourselves today, for our red and blue state thing, was set down during Reconstruction.
Absolutely, and it was set there with the other piece that we tend to ignore about the Civil War, when we're all caught up in the horrific battles and the enormous numbers of dead and the great sacrifices of women and men and African Americans and immigrants. We tend to forget that one of the critical pieces of the Civil War was the first national creation of taxation. The Civil War is the first period in which we have national American taxation. Sales taxes, which hit everybody, and income taxes, which by the end of the war hit a significant number of people. So for the first time in American history, there's a federal government that is taxing people and putting their money in its coffers. And immediately after the war, there's a big debate about who should have a say over how those tax dollars are spent. This is the period when people open up the way for African-American voting, but also for women's voting. We tend to focus on women's suffrage at the end of the 19th century, but in fact, it's 1869 that the two major women's suffrage organizations are put together.
Yeah. So we have taxation, we have suffrage, we have economic development, we have labor rights also.
Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah. Wow. And then we get to the issue, what's a special interest, too? Who has a special interest? It's going to depend on whom you ask. Is it a handout or is it a safety net?
Right. And there's a mechanism behind central interests. I think when you hear those words today, it conjures up a lot of images, but it doesn't really, the mechanism for which it is endangering the country isn't intuitively obvious. In the 19th century, it spelled out very clearly. The term special interest is used for the first time in the 1870s. And the fear is that a group of laborers, for example, or African Americans, or women suffragists are going to get together, and if they have the vote, they can use that vote to elect representatives who will then get legislation passed that will redistribute tax dollars in their favor.
Hmm. Well, let's go back to the beginning of the story, where you begin. One of the first people in the story we meet is a white Southerner, a man who was a lieutenant general in the Confederate Army, Wade Hampton. What was his situation in life? What were his politics back there, 1860?
Wade Hampton's a fascinating character, and I have been trying for years to nag a friend of mine into writing a new, very thorough biography of him, and so far I haven't succeeded. Wade Hampton was actually the wealthiest man in the South. He made enormous sums of money before the Civil War. He had 5 plantations. He owned close to 1,000 slaves. A good year before the Civil War got him about income of about $200,000, which is an astronomical sum. This is a time when a Civil War soldier in the North is going to be making about $13 a month. And yet he really did not support secession. He didn't want the South to secede. When it does, like Robert E. Lee, he goes with his state, and he manages to raise this legion. It took me forever to figure out. The reason it's called the legion is he patterns it on a Roman legion, so it has artillery, infantry, and cavalry in it. And he has enough money that he actually can supply these guys with guns himself, with the best kind of European guns you can get. But he also gives a lot of them horses from his own stables, sort of the equivalent of handing out Mercedeses. And he goes and fights this war and watches during the war everything that he had crumble. He loses, of course, his homes. Some of them are captured by the Union Army. Others are ruined. He loses his slaves. He loses his brother. And then, most heartbreakingly, he watches. His sons are in his command, and one of his sons is shot. And as his son falls off his horse, his other son, Hampton's other son, runs over to his fallen brother and starts to wave to get the medics to come over and take care of his dying brother. And by standing up and waving, he attracts a Union sniper who then shoots Wade Hampton's second son, who falls literally over his brother. The one who's wounded first dies that night. The other one does finally recover. But Hampton, who was a very austere man, very sort of old Southern gentleman, a number of the people in his legion remarked that night, who were in the tent when his son was dying, that he actually held his son in his arms and cried, which they couldn't believe that Wade Hampton would sit and cry. By the end of the war, Hampton has watched it all fade away. Mm-hmm. And there is this human tragedy in that. He is then faced with trying to rebuild. He is one of the few people that Andrew Johnson will not pardon. And he doesn't really know what to do with himself. He tries for a little while to actually embrace the idea that maybe there could be a new world with black voting because he'd be able to control black voters. But when that doesn't work out, he retreats into not the vicious racism that he's going to stand against in the 1890s, but into the desire to recreate the white world from before the Civil War. And that brings him back to power in South Carolina in the 1870s, and he remains powerful there until the rise of Ben Tillman, who is a vicious racist who advocates lynching, denies that there is any human equality, says Jefferson was wrong. And by the 1890s, Hampton, who looks like such a horrible figure in the 1870s, actually looks a lot better.
Hmm.
And then finally, Tillman is, as I say, this real party hack, and he replaces Hampton, pulls him out of the Senate and replaces him. And The Senate is so outraged by that. Hampton is an old man by now. He's lost a leg. He's very ill. And people just sort of feel like he's sorry for him. And they're so outraged, they vote unanimously to give him sort of a government job so he can to travel the railroads. He's a railroad inspector. And their big aim is to enable him to go out west so he can fish, sort of to go out and spend his old life fishing. Sort of this tragic story and a very sad story, also a horrible story because he was responsible for so much damage, both during the war and during Reconstruction. And one of those guys that I feel like we need to grapple with to really understand the period.
How did you decide on who you would include as the major characters for which to view this period?
Well, I put in characters because I got so frustrated with histories that seemed to just have forces in them, and I could never tell who was doing what. And you know, they never seem to engage with each other. And I'd grown up on Laura Ingalls Wilder, and I knew this period had actual people in it, but you couldn't prove it by some of the stuff I was reading. So there were many, many characters who could have been included, but what I demanded was that they left significant amounts of writing in their own words, either memoirs or letters, so that they could actually talk in the book, and that they lived through the whole period or else had a culturally significant death. Sitting Bull dies, of course. There's a congressman who dies and becomes a great hero when he dies. They couldn't, even if they were very important people like the man who organized an early labor protest, if they died too soon, they couldn't be in the book because the book would become too fragmented.
Very interesting.
They had to talk a lot and they had to live a long time.
Yeah. That, you know, I think that historians more and more are trying to bring us characters, people, stories of people, both famous and not so famous, as a way of giving us a better understanding of our history. That, you know, okay, there were these forces, these movements, but who was responsible for
them? Right. Well, you know, Debbie Applegate's book on Henry Ward Beecher last year, I thought was wonderful that way. I had a hard time thinking I cared about Henry Ward Beecher until I read the book, and then I felt like I wished I'd known a lot more about him a lot earlier.
Yeah, that book was featured on our morning talk program, Focus 580, some time back. So if folks are listening and would like to hear that conversation, they can go to our archives. And
I believe the Chicago Tribune also called it the best, I think the best book of the year, or at least the best biography of the year before it was named the Pulitzer.
Yeah. I haven't read it yet, but I think it should be on my list. But it was a fascinating discussion between David Inge and the author. Our guest this afternoon, historian Heather Cox Richardson. She is the author of West from Appomattox, The Reconstruction of America After the Civil War. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is The Afternoon Magazine. You can join us this afternoon with a question, with a comment, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener, a caller in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi there. Heather, it's Georgianne.
Hi, how are you?
I am enjoying your talk, and I'm looking very forward to reading your book. But you said you weren't satisfied with what you had written on Reconstruction, and I thought your book, Death of Reconstruction, was fabulous. So that kind of took me by surprise. So you thought researching this book that you learned some more and different and interesting things about Reconstruction.
Well, the trick to that one was that what I set out to figure out in that book was actually a continuation of my first book, was the question of why Northerners had turned against African Americans after the Civil War. And I came up with the idea, or concluded after reading all those gazillions of newspapers that you know about if you know the book, that Northerners turned against African Americans because they were afraid that African Americans after the Civil War, Southern African Americans, wanted to use a growing government in their favor. And I remember I was sitting, finishing the page proofs, which is the very last stage of a book when you can't change anything except commas, and reading the paragraph in that conclusion that sort of said, here, I've laid it all out, this is what I think. And I thought, oh, crap, I wrote the wrong book. Because even though Northerners talked about small government, I knew they built the biggest government we'd ever had. So while they're talking about small government, they're building a big one. And I thought, how did they get away with that? So before that book was even out, I was working on this one to figure out how they got away with building a bigger government while they were talking about a small government, which is, in fact, where they ended up by Teddy Roosevelt.
Well, I'll let you go, but looking forward to reading your next one.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other telephone calls are welcome, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Well, in general, talk with us a little bit here about what the view was of Northerners and Southerners about the role of government prior to the Civil War and after.
Well, it's important to remember that this whole concept I'm talking about what the government's role is with respect to a citizen, is not new. It's not like nobody was talking about this until 65. They've certainly been talking about it since the very concept of an America, since people are throwing around the European ideas about what a government should do, since John Locke, all those people. But it's really with the advent of national taxation and the increase of the suffrage after the war that these issues have enormous teeth, so they become the central issues of American society. And what people are really worried about after the Civil War is how that money is going to be used. And they're worried about that in part because in the 19th century, political offices were filled under the system of patronage, which meant that almost all government, in fact, all government appointments were given by the party in power. So everything from the guy digging the ditch in front of the nearby courthouse to the Indian agents, to foreign ambassadors, to clerks in the post office, those all went to whichever member of party was in whichever party was in power. You had to be a member of that party. You had to vote for that party, and ballots in that period were not secret. They were often color-coded, and people could see what you were putting in this ballot box. We don't get the secret ballot until 1890. So if the government grows dramatically and you are a member of the opposition party, you have this great fear that the government will use all this tax money to give jobs to its supporters and keep itself in power on the backs of the members of your party who are paying the taxes. So this issue has enormous teeth after the Civil War as the government is growing. It's obviously much smaller than our government is today, but it seems big to people who are used to a government before the war which did almost nothing. Mm. So there is the ongoing debate about what the government really should do. Should it be involved in the South? Well, you know, that's not just an abstract question of black rights, or white rights for that matter. It's a question of who's going to be paying for all those Freedmen's Bureau people who are all going to be Republicans, because the Republicans are running the federal government after the Civil War, and who are going to be spread throughout the South. That's thousands of new jobs. What about, you name it, what about expanding the post office? What about building new courthouses? What about improving streets? All of those jobs are going to be given by the party in power. So there is enormous, very visible teeth in the question of what is the role of government in society? Mm. What should it do? How should it protect its citizens? And to the degree that it should protect its citizens, who's going to be paying for that? Should the government be able to take money away from some guy in New Jersey in order to protect the Chinese workers, for example, who are massacred at Rock Springs in Wyoming in 1885? That's a real question that people really are watching, because they've never seen tax dollars used this way before, and they're very concerned about how it's going to be done.
Yeah. And the taxes were levied in order to pay for the war, correct? I mean, is that
right? And there had been taxes collected nationally before, but they had not actually been collected by the national government. They'd been collected. The national government had asked for them and told states they had to pony up the money, and the states had then gone and decided how to do it. But during the Civil War, national taxation is assumed by control of taxation is assumed by Congress when the old system doesn't work. And there are two major tax codes passed in 1862 and 1864, and supplements passed to both of those in 1863 and 1865. So there are these really dramatic new tax structures.
After the war, was there any debate about ending those taxes?
Yes. In fact, that's really the central question of the late years, the late 19th century years. You'll often hear that the Civil War income tax was voted out, was voted against in 1872. That's not the case. By statute, it was supposed to expire in 1870 because the Civil War Republicans were very uncomfortable with an income tax, both for philosophical reasons, and it turned out there was a funny practical problem with it, and that was that they were not secret income taxes. They were actually published in local newspapers, and young men on the make wanted to prove that their businesses were succeeding or that they could get the girl of their dreams by promising the fathers that they had made enough money. So they were exaggerating how much money they made, sometimes quite significantly, and it was actually hurting hurting development and forcing small businesses out of business because they were paying taxes on money that they'd never made. So they were very nervous about these taxes, and they designed them to expire in 1870. In fact, they're extended until 1872, but they expire in 1872 with very little discussion, because the place that money is really coming into the country, into the federal coffers by then, is from tariffs. And tariffs are, for our purposes, taxes on goods coming into the country. They're raising huge amounts of money by tariffs, but they are perceived in the country as taxes because, of course, the costs of the tariffs are being put back on the consumers. So there's a fight then. The fight over tax, there's also a fight over local and state taxation, but the fight over taxes becomes a fight over tariffs. And we all know about the late 19th century tariff fights, and they're actually much more interesting than we all think they are.
Oh, interesting. Well, let's go back and talk about some more characters. Nat Love, very interesting character.
Yeah, he's cool, isn't he?
Yeah, a former slave in Tennessee. He was one of the people who headed west.
Right.
Tell us about him.
Well, he was a young slave when the war ended, and he went west at the end of the 1860s because he actually leaves a fascinating memoir in which he talks about why people like his father couldn't make it after the Civil War. His father's an obviously enormously hardworking man who essentially works himself into the grave trying to provide for his family. And Love just gets tired of trying to make it in the South. He goes west, he becomes cowboy by his account, and it's a very boastful account. He becomes an enormously successful cowboy. He rides with the herds until the late 1880s, pretty much, and then he gives up being a cowboy and becomes a Pullman porter, which is itself a fascinating thing because in some ways it's sort of a continuation of that roving life. He settles down and marries, but of course he's on the trains, and his wife and daughter, who they have later, stay at home. So it's both a continuation of that, and he celebrates America with being on a Pullman porter train. And he talks about himself sort of. I always think of him as the Black Andrew Carnegie. He talks about himself as, you know, he's a hard worker. He's working his way up. He's doing all these great things, but he never mentions any discrimination against him in the West, which is simply impossible. He also never mentions anything about the fact that the whole reason George Pullman put black porters on his trains was to reinforce the idea of black inequality, that they would be servants. He talks repeatedly about how everybody was equal on Pullman's trains, but of course they weren't, because mm-hmm. African Americans couldn't travel on them, and most immigrants couldn't afford them. So he's this wonderful combination of somebody who dealt with the reality of the late 19th century, but also was trying so hard to believe in the idea that everybody had opportunity in America. And in fact, he writes the memoir in part, because there were a number of very successful dime novels about a guy named Deadwood Dick. And he maintained that he was the real Deadwood Dick. And he actually gives the story for how he came to be named Deadwood Dick on July 4th, 1876, actually right before they heard about the Battle of the Greasy Grass with the Little Bighorn. And he wanted to make sure that that title of Deadwood Dick, this Western hero, was not taken away from him and given to this sort of generic white cowboy in a dime novel. So it's sort of this declaration that, yes, I am the face of the West. I'm this black cowboy hero. At the same time that he is living in a world that where he's subjected to Jim Crow laws, where he can't get an education, where he couldn't ride the trains that he is working on, it's just this fascinating sort of double-edged sword and a very interesting memoir.
Yeah. His dream of America also, it seems to me, is shared by people who are coming from Europe still. There's another character in the book, Carl Schurz. He came to the U.S. from Germany in 1852, and he also had this big idealistic idea about who Americans were and what America was all about.
Yes, he's a fascinating character. He came from the German Revolution of 1848, as did a number of the German Americans, many of whom settled in Illinois around that time. And Schurz was a brilliant writer. He's worth taking a peek at. Some of his memoirs I always thought I would like to teach in a literature class, because he had such an eye for words and for images. But he believed fervently in human self-determination and in liberalism, in the idea that every man should have the right to the fruits of his own labor and should be able to stand on his own two feet without an oppressive government. And that was the principle that guided him throughout the 19th century. And unlike some ideologues, he'd laid down his life for that, both in Germany, but also briefly during the Civil War. He fought for a while before he became an ambassador. And he really cared about this. He started a new political party in 1872, trying to advance it. But it's interesting because he's one of those guys who has a firm compass point directing his own personal life in one way, and yet throughout the vagaries of late 19th century history, when we look back, to us he seems on the right side of some issues and very much on the wrong side of others, depending on where your sympathies lie in this period. So he's also a very interesting character.
Another interesting character, Quanah Parker.
Oh, isn't he great?
Yeah.
There's a lovely little biography of him by a man named William T. Hagen that deserves to be much more widely known. Quanah Parker was the son of a white woman who had been captured and adopted into the Comanche, into a branch of the Comanche tribe, one of the bands of the Comanche tribe, as a child, and considered herself Comanche. So although she was of white blood, I think you need to honor that in her mind she was a Comanche, and in the minds of her husband, and for a while at least her children, a Comanche. She had two sons and a daughter with a leader of one of the Comanche bands. And when the daughter was a little bit less than 2 years old, a number of Texas Rangers, including another character in the book, Charles Goodnight, raided a Comanche camp where she was with the child, and they captured her. They killed most of the Comanches, but they noticed she had blue eyes, and they captured her, and they took her back to her white uncle. She couldn't speak English anymore. She didn't want to be there. She tried desperately to get back to her band, but she really couldn't get there. She didn't have access to horses, and she eventually died in the custody of her uncle. The baby died as well. When that happened, Quanah and his older brother were sort of outcasts in the tribe. It's unclear what happened to his father, if he had died before that or if he died shortly after that. So Quanah at that point sort of becomes a halfway figure. He's got to make it in the Comanche tribe, and yet he is of mixed blood, so he doesn't really have the stature that he wants in the tribe. And he goes on to, when that happens, he fades further west to one of the Comanche bands that never is interested in working with the whites. Some do, but he won't. I'm sorry, that band won't. And he becomes a leader out there. And in fact, he is still honored. If you go to ComancheLodge.com, for example, he is still honored in Comanche lore for never losing a battle to the white man. And he becomes a leader of the Comanches, not really then, although he fights in the Red River War, for example. He is a major fighter. But then when the Comanches actually get cornered and their horses slaughtered by the army, 1,500 horses killed at one go, again, like driving Mercedes's off a cliff, the Comanches are really forced to turn themselves into the army. And when he does so, as soon as he does that, he starts to talk to the army officer in charge about his white mother, sort of reestablishing his white ties. And for the rest of the century, he dances between white and Comanche culture. very successful.
There's a fascinating photograph of him in the book that depicts that.
Well, and he went on, not only that, some of the photos I couldn't use, there's a wonderful image of him sitting at his table with his workers. Now, again, you don't normally think of a Comanche man sitting in a frame house at a long table with the guys he's hired. But if you do think about it, I guess I'd sort of assume they'd be, you know, Indians or maybe younger kids or whatever. He's got white men sitting at that table who work for him. So he's actually a very well-known rancher. He gives a wolf hunt for Teddy Roosevelt in the early 19th century, and he walks in Teddy Roosevelt's second inaugural parade.
Well, let's take another call. Listener in Urbana, line one, hi.
Good afternoon. I read Eric Foner's book on Reconstruction some time back, and for groups of people, I wondered if you featured in your book any of the African-American Reconstruction members of Congress or any of the carpetbaggers that came to the South to provide investment money, although they say they were resented. They brought a lot of dollars to a South that was economically devastated.
No, I don't. And then here's why. You're absolutely right. That is such a great story. And Eric Foner's really done such a good job with it. That covers that material incredibly well. Now, the one guy that I really wanted to use to focus on was Beverly Nash, who is, in fact, a black leader and a very articulate one and one that fascinated me. But he has very few papers. So when I tried to track him down, he shows up in the book some, but I couldn't focus on him because there just wasn't enough to go on. And for the white carpetbaggers, I did, and that's, of course, a pejorative term that they used, I didn't use them that much because I tended to focus on the guys in Congress at that point. And there just didn't seem to be room for everybody. But it is a fascinating story of how just the economic story of what was going on in the South between the Northern money coming in and the attempts to keep Northern money there when there is, in fact, chaos going on in the South. One of the big arguments against the KKK is that if they don't stop, Northern money's not going to come, and British money won't come into the South to help rebuild it. It'd be fun to see more work done on that.
And no one challenged the idea of white racial superiority at any time at all, I don't expect. I've heard of a book called, written just before the Civil War, called The Types of Mankind, which I think polluted the Academy, written by Josiah Nott and Louis Agassiz, who's a Swiss academic, and according to a different book called Complicity. This book was snapped up by racists because it told them what they wanted to hear based on what we would today call junk science or pseudoscience.
Absolutely, but as you point out, this is not then considered junk science. That's Louis Agassiz is Agassiz as in Harvard's Agassiz. So he goes on to have an illustrious academic career at Harvard.
Unfortunately.
Now, I won't say nobody is challenging it, though, because there are a number of very articulate and very thoughtful black writers and politicians who are very clear about the way they feel about not just racial superiority, but about the equality of races, and also the need for political equality. And that, again, is going to be a fascinating book when somebody traces down, for example, the whole intellectual argument behind 40 Acres and a Mule. In fact, if you follow out the Lockean idea that you're entitled to whatever your labor has produced, they were right. So, you know, that's something I don't think anybody really wanted to deal with at the time.
I think you're right. Thank you.
Sure.
Well, let's talk with another listener. A caller waiting for us in Robinson on line four. Hi.
Celeste,
yes?
I'd like for you and your guest to realize that Quanah Parker had Crawford County, Illinois roots.
Did he?
Yes. His grandfather was a Baptist preacher here in Crawford County who moved to Texas in the 1830s. Incidentally, he was anti-slavery when he was in Illinois, but quickly became pro-slavery once he got down there.
Now, that's fascinating. How do you know that?
Well, the whole family is a well-known clan here in Robinson, Crawford County, Illinois. They were a large clan that had come from the Carolinas, I believe, and settled here. And actually, the preacher wrote one of the first books ever published in Illinois, a book of sermons published in Mount Carmel, I think, in the 1820s.
See, it really is a national story, isn't it?
Yes. I just thought I'd toss that tidbit in.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the call. Crawford County is in it's in east central Illinois, but it's almost southeastern central Illinois. It's almost south. But anyway, very, very interesting. I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, before we run out of time, we better talk about a woman or two. Julia Ward Howe, Elizabeth Alston, Jane Addams, who would you like to talk about?
I'm partial to Julia Ward Howe.
Okay.
And they're all great women, and they're, of course, only three that you mentioned of the thousands, millions you could have taken from the late 19th century. But Julia Ward Howe has a special place in my heart because we know her husband, and I try not to say his name because I like the idea that we're bringing her back to the fore again and not him. You would know it if I said it. And he was abusive, and she tried desperately to live a productive and a happy life despite the fact that she was in this relationship with a man whom she couldn't leave, and she couldn't leave him because of the way divorce laws were in the 19th century. Men automatically got the children, and she was very attached to her children. And every time that she tried to leave, he'd say, fine, go ahead, and you'll never see your kids again. And she also suffered from what we would now call, with one child, I think what we would now call parental alienation, the child who sided with her husband on every occasion. And she, you know, she was full of self-doubt about what she was doing with her life because she believed that God had called her to be a philosopher, but also to be a poet and to have a public presence. And the tension between what she thought God wanted her to do and what she had to do to obey her higher duty to God put her at exact odds with exactly what her husband wanted her to do. And she kept a diary of it. She kept a very extensive diary for most of her life where she chronicled these very private doubts and tried to figure out how she was going to negotiate her life. She goes on, and obviously we know her from things like the Battle Hymn of the Republic, which again, in a way, if you think of that line when she talks about Christ being born of women, I'm sorry, of woman, to me I sit there and I say this is a woman who is once again emphasizing that women gave birth to Christ. A woman gave birth to Christ, so they shouldn't have their kids taken away from them if they're trying to do God's will. I mean, I think you can read a lot of what she does both in her life, but also she's trying to serve a higher purpose. So she converts, again, very sort of contrary to, she's a fairly wealthy Bostonian, sort of contrary to what you'd expect, she converts very early to suffrage. And she converts to that because, again, she feels that the way the laws are, she has no say in the laws, and the way the laws are, her husband is preventing her from from reaching her higher calling. But they muddle along together. And he does awful things to her. Like, he sells the house out from under her without telling her, all kinds of stuff, in addition to the stuff with her children. And they muddle along together, and after he dies, she writes sort of this bittersweet memoir in which she lionizes this guy because he's a famous American, and yet there's also this sense of, if he was so great, why couldn't we get along? So this tension in her I find just absolutely fascinating. Mm.
What biography? Is there a good biography of her out?
Well, you know, I hate to slam or to praise because there's about three new ones out. I would say that she is such a complicated character, there's always plenty of more room for work on her. One of the things that's daunting is, as I say, the Howes were a very prominent family, and there are literally thousands of feet of their papers at Harvard's Houghton Library, and she fancied herself a philosopher. So many of them are full of literally hundreds of pages of musings on Kant's philosophy, for example, and that I think will be hard for a biographer to face reading, let alone put a good intellectual understanding onto.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. We're out of time, unfortunately. I want to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Heather Cox Richardson has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's Associate Professor of History at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and she is the author most recently of West from Appomattox, The Reconstruction of America After the Civil War. The book is published by Yale.